Blog Talk Radio.
Saturday morning, and this is Blog Talk Radio. It's Saturday morning in Colorado, but with me are my dear friends and my co-host, Andre Rodatis. Hi, Andre. Good day to you.
Well, good day to you, Paula.
Thank you. And also we have on the line with us our comrades in this adventure through the study on the Master Seraphim, Mr. Neil Waldrop. Hi, Neil. Thank you so much for this study and for leading us through it.
Paula, it's been a great privilege and a tremendous pleasure of mine. I am very appreciative of all the comments that you and others have put forward.
And we also have our good friend and comrade who has helped us most of this way. I think you've only missed a couple of shows, and that's Mr. Charles Olivier. Hi, Charles.
Good morning, Paula. Top of the morning to you.
Top of the morning to you, too. You're in Connecticut right now. Charles is on the road, so he may sound a little distant being on speakerphone, but, boy, we're so glad you're with us this week. We missed you last week.
Well, I was on the road then, but I'm in one of my son's houses now.
Oh, okay. Good. And Bob Diebold has joined us again. Bob, thank you so much for coming back on with us.
Well, thank you, Paula. Good morning to you, and good afternoon to the rest of the
group.
Crowd here.
Yeah.
Yes, good afternoon.
Well, it's been a wonderful study session, and we have a great study group here, I think, in all of you gentlemen. And I don't think Crystalyn will be joining us today. I hope so. She may call in here in a little bit. So we'll look forward to hearing from Crystalyn if she does call in. But, Neil, I'm going to let you take it away, and maybe you can fill us in on where we are and where we left off last week and go from there.
Thank you very much, Paula. Many listeners may have followed us as we have proceeded through this discussion of the study guide on the Master Seraphim. We are now within the last few pages, and in fact, in the last question numerically, question 10 of 10. This question, however, is quite detailed and lengthy in itself, and I'm sure we have more than enough material that we could discuss during this broadcast. Now, for those listeners who may not already have downloaded the study guide, I recommend very strongly that you do that. You will find it much easier to follow our discussion if you have the study guide in front of you. Here is the website from which you can download it. It's www.globalendeavor.net. Global Endeavor is one word, GLOBALENDEAVOR, and then .net. The link to download the study guide is near the bottom of the homepage. As in previous weeks, we are going to start by reading Section 6 of Paper 114, this section pertaining to the Master Seraphim, and you will have time to download the study guide while we are reading through it. I understand that Charles Olivier is willing to read the first segment of the section on the Master Seraphim, starting at the beginning of the section and running through the paragraph numbered 4, the Angels of Nation Life. Would you proceed to do that, Charles?
I will. Paper 114, Seraphic Planetary Government, Section 6, Master Seraphim of Planetary Supervision. When the first Governor General arrived on Urantia, concurrent with the outpouring of the Spirit of Truth, he was accompanied by 12 corps of special seraphim, the Raffington graduates who were immediately assigned to certain special planetary services. These exalted angels are known as the Master Seraphim of Planetary Supervision and are, aside from the overcontrol of the Planetary Most High Observer, under the immediate direction of the resident Governor General. These 12 groups of angels, while functioning under the general supervision of the resident Governor General, are immediately directed by the Seraphic Council of 12, the acting chiefs of each group. This council also serves as the volunteer cabinet of the resident Governor General. As Planetary Chief of Seraphim, I preside over this council of Seraphic Chiefs, and I am a voluntary Saturnian of the primary order, serving on Urantia as the successor of the one-time chief of the angelic host of the planet, who defaulted at the time of the Caligastia secession. The 12th corps of the Master Seraphim of Planetary Supervision are functional on Urantia as follows. Number 1, the Epical Angel. These are the angels of the current age, the dispensational group. These celestial ministers are entrusted with the oversight and direction of the affairs of each generation as they are designed to fit into the mosaic of the age in which they occur. The present corps of epical angels serving on Urantia is the third group assigned to the planet during the current dispensation. Number 2, the progress angels. These seraphim are entrusted with the task of initiating the evolutionary progress of the successive social ages. They foster the development of the inherent progressive trend of evolutionary creatures. They labor incessantly to make things what they ought to be. The group now on duty is the second to be assigned to the planet. 3, or third, the religious guardians. These are the angels of the churches, the earnest contenders for that which is and has been. They endeavor to maintain the ideals of that which has survived for the sake of the safe transit of moral values from one epoch to another. They are the checkmates of the angels of progress, all the while seeking to translate from one generation to another the imperishable values of the old and passing forms into the new and therefore less stabilized patterns of thought and conduct. These angels do contend for spiritual form, but they are not the source of ultra-sectarianism and meaningless controversial divisions of professed religionists. The corps now functioning on Urantia is the fifth, thus to serve. Fourth, the angels of nation life. These are the angels of the trumpets, directors of the political performances of Urantia national life. The group now functioning in the over-control of international relations is the fourth corps to serve on the planet. It is particularly through the ministry of this seraphic division that the Most Highs rule in the kingdoms of men.
Thank you, Charles. Paula, would you be willing to... Sure. Paula, would you be willing to read the next sections, starting with paragraph numbered 5 all the way through paragraph numbered 12?
Sure. Number 5, the angels of the races. Those who work for the conservation of the evolutionary races of time, regardless of their political entanglements and religious groupings. On Urantia, there are remnants of 9 human races, which have commingled and combined into the people of modern times. These seraphim are closely associated with the ministry of the race commissioners. And the group on Urantia, and the group now on Urantia, is the original core assigned to the planet soon after the day of Pentecost. The angels of the future. These are the projection angels, who forecast a future age and plan for the realization of better things, of a new and advancing dispensation. They are the architects of the successive eras. The group now on the planet has thus functioned since the beginning of the current dispensation. Number 7, the angels of enlightenment. Urantia is now receiving the help of the third corps of seraphim dedicated to the fostering of planetary education. These angels are occupied with mental and moral training as it concerns individuals, families, groups, schools, communities, nations, and whole races. Number 8, the angels of health. These are the seraphic ministers assigned to the assistance of those mortal agencies dedicated to the promotion of health and the prevention of disease. The present corps is the 6th group to serve during this dispensation. Number 9, the home seraphim. Urantia now enjoys the services of the 5th group evangelic ministers dedicated to the preservation and advancement of the home, the basic institution of human civilization. Number 10, the angels of industry. This seraphic group is concerned with fostering industrial development and improving economic conditions among the Urantia peoples. This corps has been 7 times changed since the bestowal of Michael. Number 11, the angels of diversion. These are the seraphim who foster the values of play, humor, and rest. They ever seek to uplift man's recreational diversions and thus to promote the more profitable utilization of human leisure. The present corps is the 3rd of that order to minister on Urantia. Number 12, the angels of superhuman ministry. These are the angels of the angels, those seraphim who are assigned to the ministry of all other superhuman life on the planet, temporary or permanent. This corps has served since the beginning of the current dispensation.
Thank you, Paula. The remaining 4 paragraphs of this section concern the methods that the Master Seraphim use. Andre, would you be willing to read those paragraphs for us, please?
Sure, I'd be glad to. Thank you. When these groups of Master Seraphim disagree in matters of planetary policy or procedure, their differences are usually composed by the Governor General, but all his rulings are subject to appeal in accordance with the nature and gravity of the issues involved in the disagreement. None of these angelic groups exercise direct or arbitrary control over the domains of their assignment. They cannot fully control the affairs of their respective realms of action, but they can and do so manipulate planetary conditions and so associate circumstances as favorably to influence the spheres of human activity to which they are attached. The Master Seraphim of Planetary Supervision utilize many agencies for the prosecution of their missions. They function as ideational clearinghouses, mind focalizers, and project promoters. While unable to inject new and higher conceptions into human minds, they often act to intensify some higher ideal which has already appeared within a human intellect. But aside from these many means of positive action, the Master Seraphim ensure planetary progress against vital jeopardy through the mobilization, training, and maintenance of the Reserve Corps of Destiny. The chief function of these reservists is to ensure against breakdown of evolutionary progress. They are the provisions which the celestial forces have made against surprise. They are the guarantees against disaster.
Thank you, Andre. We will now move into the study guide. And again, for the listeners who may have joined us a bit late, I recommend very strongly that you have the study guide in front of you. You can download it from the following website, www.globalendeavor.net. Global Endeavor is one word, GlobalEndeavor.net. The link to download the study guide is near the bottom of the homepage on that website. We are now on page 11 of the study guide, specifically starting question 10. I would point out that the structure of the study guide is based on the insight of the Divine Counselor in paper 19, section 1, wherein he says that studying any human problem requires an awareness of origin, history, and destiny. Therefore, the first couple pages of the study guide follow the heading Origin. On page 3, we have the heading History Since Pentecost, and starting on page 8, the heading Destiny During the Current Millennium. So we are now in that final portion, Destiny During the Current Millennium, and specifically on the final question, question 10. This question is very long, and I will pause at certain parts of the question in order to allow discussion even before we reach the concluding specific questions that are posed as matters to discuss. So here we begin. Question 10. In paper 134, immediately before the Midwayer Commission proceeds to summarize and adapt the ideas that Jesus presented during his lectures at Urmia, the Midwayer Commission describes an extended controversy that pitted the seraphim of the churches against the seraphim of progress. Quote, when we, the Midwayers, first prepared the summary of Jesus' teachings at Urmia, there arose a disagreement between the seraphim of the churches and the seraphim of progress as to the wisdom of including these teachings in the Urantia Revelation. Conditions of the 20th century, prevailing in both religion and human governments, are so different from those prevailing in Jesus' day that it was indeed difficult to adapt the Master's teachings at Urmia to the problems of the kingdom of God and the kingdoms of men as these world functions are existent in the 20th century. We were never able to formulate a statement of the Master's teachings which was acceptable to both groups of the seraphim of planetary government. Finally, the Melchizedek chairman of the Revelatory Commission appointed a commission of three of our number to prepare our view of the Master's Urmia teachings as adapted to 20th century religious and political conditions on Urantia. Accordingly, we three secondary Midwayers completed such an adaptation of Jesus' teachings, restating his pronouncements as we would apply them to present-day world conditions. And we now present these statements as they stand after having been edited by the Melchizedek chairman of the Revelatory Commission. End quotation by the Midwayer Commission, page 1486 in the one-column edition, paper 134, section 3. This account of sincere differences amidst respect for the viewpoints of others is entirely in keeping with the broad themes of diversity, pluralism, and mutual respect that characterize and permeate the Revelation. The Revelators did not promote uniformity by writing anonymously and collectively. To the contrary, each author fostered diversity by identifying himself or herself, usually by telling us the category of beings to which he or she belongs, rather than by giving a personal name. Nonetheless, many current readers have adopted the unfortunate habit of introducing quotations by declaring, "The Urantia Book says." In effect, this method of speaking and writing implicitly amounts to claiming that the fifth epical revelation embodies only a single uniform viewpoint. Since it does not, there appear to be sound reasons for wondering whether that tacit assertion of monolithic uniformity conflicts with the fundamental spirit of the teachings, perhaps even undermining a key characteristic that distinguishes the Urantia book from previous works that were considered revealed or inspired. I would now like to pause in the question by offering the opportunity to the participants in this discussion to comment on this description that I have just provided. Who would like to launch that discussion?
I'll be glad to jump in. Just on the concept and how this first struck me when I was reading, what you were stating here, and I think it's actually a very interesting point that you're making. That while I've had in the back of my mind, and certainly at various points in my study, and certainly have grown to appreciate over time, it sort of underlined and underscored this for me in a way that it hadn't before I read it this way in your study guide. The idea that, you know, there really is something of both personality, but of the nature of the order of each of these beings that is not only coloring their perspective, but definitely defining where they're coming from, and taking it out of the context of the idea of this being a monolithic treatise that would somehow be echoing what we as human beings have been used to in referring back to quote-unquote scripture for those of us that grew up in a Western tradition, or back to, you know, sacred writings from any other tradition. And I think that was an excellent point that you brought up in the study guide here. But what it also brings up to me is something that maybe a lot of newer readers, and by newer readers I mean readers in the last 20 or 30 years, may not be aware of, that was actually something employed by some number of students of the Urantia book back 40 years ago and before, and I'm not sure when this actually started. But when I was a much younger reader, I came across, you know, my first readers back about 35 years ago. And when I first started reading or studying with readers in the Toronto area, many of them had been, you know, studying with other readers for quite a while. And I noticed for some of the readers, there was a reader by the name of Hans Vankerberg that came from the New York City area. He was a piano tuner from that area, and on his book, I believe it was his book, and I saw this subsequently on other people's books, on the top of every page, using rubber stamps, the name of each of the authors of the papers, and by name I mean the order of being of each of the authors of the papers, was stamped with a rubber stamp, an ink stamp, basically, in about 24 to 36 point type. And this was at the top of each paper. And so it was something that was current sometime maybe 50 or 40 years ago for readers to actually make themselves be aware while they were reading every page who the author of that particular paper was. I found that fascinating, especially as a young reader way back then. And so while I didn't stamp the top of every page, I did pay much more attention to who the author was of every paper as I was reading it. So I found that very fascinating.
Thank you. Who is the next person to talk about this point?
Well, can jump in here with this, Bob.
Bob DeBolt, please go ahead.
Yes. Truth be told, I've used Neil as an editor for some of my papers, and he's done just a wonderful job. And the very first paper that I ever did, I took the approach which is in this last paragraph here, and many of my sentences started with "The Urantia Book says," and I have to say that Neil has brought up an interesting point to me, and over time, probably the last decade or so, I think is what comes to mind here, is that, like you just said, Andre, when you think about, you know, what a particular paper or who wrote a particular paper, what celestial entity wrote the paper, and understanding either the function or the description of that particular entity, for example, a mighty messenger or a divine counselor, puts a perspective on how you read it, and actually puts a context of how you read it, and provides you, I think, with a perspective that isn't monolithic, and that goes back to what the question will be eventually about the diversity, pluralism, and mutual respect eventually. So I think this is a good point to take, and typically I try to go forward and find out, do I really know who's really writing this? So so I've been schooled in this, to say the least.
Well, I would
I'm
like
gonna,
to
I'm gonna,
okay, go ahead,
go ahead.
Paula. No,
you
go ahead, and then I'll tweak it a little bit. Go ahead.
I'm going to take a counter point of view, not drastically, but and I agree that, especially when we're talking to each other, I think it's very insightful and helpful to know who wrote the paper. And I very much appreciate that, Neil, that you've done that. And especially in this study, you'll say a divine counselor or a midwayer tells us, or because after having read the book, that gives me, I feel like I at least somewhat know the position that these beings hold in the universe of universes and in the universe. And I know, in a sense, where they're coming from, so it really helps me get perspective. If you say, well, a Melchizedek said, I'm like, okay, I get that, and that's helpful to me. When I'm talking to people who know nothing about the Urantia Book, if I were to say to them, well, a divine counselor says, and they know nothing about who a divine counselor is, it sounds very strange to them. So that's probably why I would try to do that with a non-reader, and I've done a lot of outreach. So from that point of view, it helps to give them a taste of the book just to get them in the temple, so to speak, without making it sound too far afield, too hard for them to, you know, get into, or throwing up a roadblock, say. But I do appreciate the point, and I do appreciate that you, for the purpose of our study and for the purpose of education amongst other readers, that we designate. And I want to point out also that I think it's remarkable that the book does have, with these many authors who collaborated to give us a revelation of truth, that it is so coherent and so cohesive. And that the threads, the golden threads through the book, about evolution, about humanity, about God, about the love of God, about Jesus, about, the cosmology, they're all just beautifully woven together. And I don't think that, you know, that may be unprecedented.
Thank you very much, Paula. I agree with you about the spiritual harmony of the material amidst intellectual and philosophic diversity. After all, the revelators are all on the same team. And so there is certainly a team spirit to the writings that they put forward. I think in relation to your own comment about speaking to someone who is not familiar with the Urantia Book, one way of solving that problem is to use a general phrase such as, one of the authors of the Urantia Book tells us that. And this gets away from the need to use the phrase the divine counselor, which will be indeed a phrase that the person does not expect or understand. But I would like to point to another element that is implied in this passage. It has to do with the implicit authority that is usually a spiritual consequence of contemplating a uniform set of writings that are assumed to have spiritual validity. In other words, a single monolithic text tends to overwhelm the creativity and individuality of the listener, or the reader, I should say. Whereas we are told about diverse viewpoints, the revelators identify themselves individually or most frequently by category of beings. And the example from the paper about Jesus' presentations at Urmia shows that these very sincere, highly motivated, spiritually intuitive beings could have sincere disagreements, and that there were ways of resolving that. So to me, the implication is that it is entirely legitimate for all of us who read the Urantia book to have diverse viewpoints. There is no monolithic, uniform interpretation, and we certainly should respect each other. Now, in effect, I've deviated from my usual path because I've supplied part of the answer to my own question, but I appeal to you for patience in listening, and I now offer the opportunity for anyone else who would like to comment either on anything that I have said just now or on any other element that appeals to you for the moment.
Well, this is Charles speaking.
Thank you, Charles.
When speaking to a non-reader about the Urantia book, I also use a phrase similar to one of the authors says, which indicates to the person that there's more than one reader and perhaps some differentiation in presentation. The Urantia book, clearly in the Urantia book, the various teachings of the various authors, beginning with the Divine Counselor, clearly indicate a preference, strong preference, for unity, not uniformity. That point is made, is woven as a thread throughout the teachings of the book. It is applied to specifically different topics, but it's a consistent thread. Unity allows for, or unity recognizes and values individuality. Uniformity, of course, does not. I don't see, that's very clear in the text. And going back to your original point about people characterizing the statements in the book as the Urantia book says, I wanted to make the point that imprecision, I'll say it again, imprecision is a pronounced characteristic of human thinking. And the book is a lesson for us on many levels, and that's one of them, to think more logically, more precisely, to make connections more sensibly, rationally, reasonably. Also to be inspired. So there's a balance between the rational and the passionate in this book as a whole. Some of the authors, I think, tend to lean more toward reason. Others lean more toward what we would call emotion or feeling. But they all embrace a respect for rationality and for feeling, for thinking and feeling. And we're encouraged to, the book encourages us to improve mind, to improve thought. But I think their task in putting together the content of the Urantia book is so multifaceted in terms of facts, meanings, and values, and origin, nature, and destiny, that number one, it required an array of authors from many backgrounds. I would estimate there are at least 50 authors to the book, varying degrees of engagement and expertise and experience. And the book simply reflects, encourages conversation. Pedagogy in the book encourages conversation. It raises questions, whereas a text that humans reading it raise questions, which are subsequently addressed. And the study of the book appears to be very much to lend itself to a group process built upon individual process. All of that supports your point of view, Neil, that diversity of opinion is to be respected.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you very much, Charles, and I want to thank all of you for contributing your ideas to this particular point. I agree implicitly that there is a range of possibilities in regard to this point, too. This is another subject of diversity. And what we have now in the continuation of this question...
Neil, this is Bob, just if I could hold you for a quick second.
Sure.
Yeah, I just thought I would, since we're going forward with diversity, pluralism, and respect, it caused me to look up pluralism to ensure that I really understood it. So if I could just toss that out for a second, because I know we're going forward with these thoughts. I think that, you know, we're going to probably hit these at the end of the question. One of the interesting things that I found, and I'll throw this out to the group, is that diversity is just that. It's diverse, multiple, more than one. But pluralism implies that this diversity is embedded in some kind of a common domain. One of the definitions is a state of society in which members of a diverse ethnic, racial, religious, or social groups maintain and develop their traditional culture of special interest within the confines of the common civilization. So it appears to me that that the papers are written by a diverse group of authors, but the book itself expresses a pluralism, and many of the topics, such as the one that that you actually read at the beginning of question 10 here, Neil, show that mutual respect is absolutely important to be able to be pluralistic with this diversity of opinion. So I wanted to kind of put how I'm seeing this going forward.
Thank you. That was very helpful.
Yeah.
I would like now to go forward with this question in terms of the way that it appears in the text of the study guide. As all of you who are aware, because you reviewed it previously, the next chunk of this material consists of 10 excerpts from the Urantia book epitomizing diversity of opinion and respect for pluralism. I would like to point out that there are, in effect, groupings of these 10 segments. The first four quotations at the top of page 12 into the middle come from part one. Then at the bottom of page 12 and the first quotation on the top of page 13, we have four quotations from part three. And then in the middle of page 13, we have two quotations from part four. So I would like to proceed that way by dividing the consideration of these 10 passages, four, then four, and then two. And for the sake of variety, I would like to ask someone to volunteer to read the first four quotations on the top of page 12. I do have to start with a one sentence at the bottom of page 11 that precedes it, which is, throughout the Urantia book, the authors treat situations that involve a range of opinions and beliefs as being entirely natural or even desirable. Mm. Now, would someone like to read the first four quotations on page 12?
I'd be happy
no
to.
No one volunteers. I will call on someone. I'm sorry.
I was hoping for Charles. I think he sounds more like a divine counselor than anybody here.
Oh. Well, Charles, I hope you'll accept that description.
He does, indeed.
What a wild exaggeration. page 11 of the...
No, page 12.
Well, I thought you wanted me to start at the bottom of page 11.
I read that sentence. Throughout the Urantia book, the authors treat situations that involve a range of opinions and beliefs as being entirely natural or desirable. So I would like you now to proceed to read the first four excerpts on page 12.
You got it. The Universal Father has an eternal purpose, pertaining to the material, intellectual, and spiritual phenomena of the universe of universes, which he is executing throughout all time. God created the universes of his own free will, his own free and sovereign will, and he created them in accordance with his all-wise and eternal purpose. It is doubtful whether anyone except the paradise deities and their highest associates really knows very much about the eternal purpose of God. Even the exalted citizens of paradise hold very diverse opinions about the nature of the eternal purpose of the deities. Paper 54, Section 1, by a divine counselor. Secondly.
Excuse me, Charles, that's page 54, paragraph 1 in paper 4.
It is. All right. Well, thank you. I use a different notation. Thank you.
So please go on with the second quotation.
So the subsequent after the author is the page and paragraph, is that it?
The first number here is page and paragraph, followed by paper
and section. Then there's a slash, and then that's paper and section.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Right, it's a dual citation reference.
Yes, indeed. The unqualified absolute is functionally limited to space. We are not so sure about the relation of this absolute to motion. Is motion inherent therein? We do not know. We know that motion is not inherent in space. Even the motions of space are not innate. We are not so sure about the relation of the unqualified to motion. Who or what is really responsible for the gigantic activities of force energy transmutations now in progress out beyond the borders of the present seven super universes? Concerning the origin of motion, we have the following opinions. Number one, we think the conjoint actor initiates motion in space. Two, if the conjoint actor produces the motions of space, we cannot prove it. Three, the universal absolute does not originate initial motion, but does equalize and control all the tensions originated by motion. This was written by a perfecter of wisdom, page 133, paragraphs 4 through 7, and or paper 12, section 4, paragraphs 2 through 5. Did I do that correctly?
That was perfect.
I'm just joking. Just funning.
It was actually not only perfect, but a perfecter of wisdom.
Yeah, there you go.
The higher a creature's, this is the third quotation, the higher a creature's education, the more respect he has for the knowledge, experience, and opinions of others. This is authored by One High in Authority, page 278, paragraph 3, or paper 25, section 3, paragraph 12. The fourth quotation. We deem that human beings are entitled to share our opinions, and that you are free to conjecture with us respecting the mystery of the ultimate destiny of the paradise core of finality. It seems evident to us that the present assignment of the perfected evolutionary creatures partake of the nature of postgraduate courses in universe understanding and super-universe administration. And we all ask, quote, why should the gods be so concerned in so thoroughly training surviving mortals in the technique of universe management, end quote. This is co-authored by a divine counselor and one without name and number, page 348, paragraph 5, or paper 31, section 3, paragraph 8.
Thank you, Charles. So these four quotations that Charles has just read all come from part one of the Urantia book, and they embody a wide range of intellectual or philosophic questions on which there are and can be a range of diverse opinions. Does anyone wish to comment or analyze these four excerpts?
I would like to make a few observations that come off the top of my head. Number one, not to know something is not necessarily ignorance. It should not be confused necessarily with ignorance. Not in the negative sense of the term. Not to know something signifies, can signify, and can and may signify that a person is intellectually honest, that a person is humble and self-confident. As a teacher, as a high school, public high school classroom teacher, I only had one occasion in 40-some-odd years of teaching, only one, in which a student disparaged me for not knowing something. That's a very high record. Students respected me for my knowledge, but didn't expect me to be God. And I think it's very, very important for people to, any person, to acknowledge what they know and what they don't know, and to then pursue an answer. And the other comment, corollary to that, would be that speculation inherently, necessarily, I think, entails a realization that you may not know something clearly or well, but you are pursuing it, or at least you're questioning. I think is a positive.
Thank you. Anyone else?
Well, just generally, I love this concept. I cherish it. It's unique, I think. Here are these amazing... I mean, you know, when you read this book, you feel the intellect, the power of the thought, the wisdom, the desire, the noble intention to teach, to give freely. You feel it so keenly, so clearly. And for them to say, well, we want you to speculate with us here. We like to speculate. And I know we've said this in the last few shows a couple of times, and we've explored this concept, but it's just really so beautiful. My friend Steve McIntosh likes to say, that's one Melchizedek's opinion. And I love that, really, because... You know, it's like the Zen Buddhists say, you know, where is your beginner's mind? It's great to, and Jesus also said this in his great discourse on religion, you know, it's great what the prophets have said, but what do you say? You know, you do well to quote the prophets, but you would do better to become as living prophets. Think for yourselves. You know, humanity, you know, has been held down. When he said, I've come to set the spiritual captives free, and to imagine that you've been unleashed to contemplate every possible problem or subject under the universe, in the universe, and you can do this, and you have their permission. It's like Jesus saying, seek, ask, knock. It's so liberating to know that you've been set free to think for yourselves. You don't have to have a middleman telling you what to think. And that they value your own insights. They value them. It's awesome.
I agree with you. And this concept of valuing speculation and personal interpretation epitomizes spiritual unity among diversity. As Andre said at the beginning of this discussion, the revelators are not promoting uniformity. Maybe, I'm sorry, that may have been a comment from Charles rather than Andre.
That probably was, yeah.
Yes. Well, anyway, the point is still valid. It's not uniformity that they're seeking. We are not instructed to believe in a uniform way. There is no group of a spiritual or religious character that has the authority to inflict a uniform interpretation.
Yeah.
Isn't that
to me,
wonderful?
That's a huge difference with many parts of various traditions of religiosity on our planet.
Yeah.
Does anyone want to add further thought before we go on to the second?
Yes, we all have a thought, this Bob.
Please.
Speculate versus conjecture, or speculation versus conjecturing. Slight differences. Just thought I'd put them on the table here. Speculating, you know, we use it in our language as speculators actually assume risk, but it also means that you review something and don't come to a conclusion. Conjecturing is you've already gone through speculation and you've come to a conclusion, but both of these things actually imply some risk on the individual who's speculating and conjecturing if, in fact, there's not a healthy mutual respect. So that's why all three of those things that Neil brought up earlier, diversity, pluralism, and mutual respect, I think go hand in hand and are fairly important to consider as we, you know, as we go forward and look at this. We've been implored in a number of places in the papers, I can't remember exactly where they are, to both speculate and conjecture. So, you know, you've all said it more eloquently than I have about why we want to do this, but what it does is stimulate the mind and stimulates ideas and ideals.
Can I add one more comment, Neil?
Please go ahead.
I just want to say that, you know, this quote, the higher a creature's education, the more respect he has for the knowledge, experience, and opinions of others. I know you probably all experienced that, but I've never experienced it so keenly as I have at the Parliament of the World's Religions, wherein all of the religions of the world that participate in the Parliament send essentially the cream of their crop to represent them. And I was absolutely struck there, and I've attended every one of them since 1993, I'm struck by this every time, that these wonderful religionists who have gone so deep and so broad in their own respective discipline have so much respect for the ideas and concepts of others. It's just amazing.
Paula, that is indeed amazing, but I would point out to you a certain anomaly. Many of these same people who show respect for each other nevertheless enforce uniformity on the believers who are subordinate to them in their own religions.
That's a very good point.
One interesting thing as well, I really appreciate all the different nuances that people have been pointing out. This one with that quote that Paula just quoted, and the one after it, are signal in different ways. I mean, they all are good. But the fact that this third quote is by an actual former human being, one high in authority is one who is a Trinitized son who shows particular administrative and executive wisdom and has been Trinitized because of that. After their long ascent, and instead of remaining finaliters, they are Trinitized as one high in authority. As this case, it's instructive to note that this is the author that's making that statement, one who has actually risen in that particular way. Although other authors make similar statements, even though they haven't experientially risen in wisdom. The fourth quote is interesting because a being of native divine perfection is with another one that has risen through the ranks, one without name and number, who shows a particular affinity for understanding the spiritual purpose of God and is also a former ascendant mortal. And the idea that they should be making a joint statement this way and allowing, I mean, who knows, this particular paragraph might be one without name and numbers or the divine counselors, but they're sharing authorship of this particular point. And that would indicate that there's no caste system among those of high and divine origin with those that have risen to literally seven-stage spirit status alongside them.
Andre, thank you very much. I will succumb to the temptation to point out that the first of those two examples you praised, the author identified as one high in authority, has made a statement about respecting the opinions and knowledge and experience of others. And so just if we take those words, this establishes that authority as such does not consist in enforcing uniformity of opinion.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
All right.
Excellent.
Now, I'd like to proceed to the next set of four quotations. These four quotations, starting with the one that begins, "Just as certainly as men share their religious beliefs," are taken from part three, and they conclude with the quotation at the top of page 13, which starts with the words, "The Supreme Being functions primarily." Bob DeBold, would you be willing to read these four quotations for us, please?
Sure. Very glad to, Neil.
Good.
First one is, "Just as certainly as men share their religious beliefs, they create a religious group of some sort which eventually creates common goals. Someday religionists will get together and actually effect cooperation on the basis of unity of ideals and purposes rather than attempting to do so on the basis of psychological opinions and theological beliefs. Goals rather than creeds should unify religionists." That was written by M. Melchizedek, single page 1091, paragraph 6, paper 99, section 5, paragraph 7. Number 2, "Some believe that Macaventa will not come to take personal direction of Urantian affairs until the end of the current dispensation. Others hold that the vicegerent prince may not come as such until Michael sometime returns to Urantia as he promised when still in the flesh. Still others, including this narrator, look for Melchizedek's appearance any day or hour." This was written by the chief of Seraphim, page 1251, paragraph 3, or paper 114, section 1, paragraph 4. Third paragraph, or third quote. "No one knows how long these 24 Urantia counselors will continue in their present status, detached from the regular program of universe activities. They will no doubt continue to serve in their present capacities until some change in planetary status ensues, such as the end of a dispensation, the assumption of full authority by Macaventa Melchizedek, the final adjudication of the Lucifer Rebellion, or the reappearance of Michael on the world of the final bestowal. The present resident governor general of Urantia seems inclined to the opinion that all but Macaventa may be released for paradise ascension the moment the system of Sustania is restored to the constellation circuits. But other opinions are also current." This was also written by the chief of Seraphim, page 1252, paragraph 4, or paper 114, section 2, paragraph 6. And the last quote, "The Supreme Being functions primarily in the central universe as a spirit personality, secondarily in the grand universe as God the Almighty, a personality of power. The tertiary function of the Supreme in the master universe is now latent, existing only as an unknown mind potential. No one knows just what this third development of the Supreme Being will disclose. Some believe that when the super universes are settled in light and life, the Supreme will become functional from Universa as the almighty and experiential sovereign of the grand universe, while expanding in power as the super almighty of the outer universes. Others speculate that the third stage of supremacy will involve the third level of deity manifestation, but none of us really know." And this one was written by a mighty messenger, page 1268, single version, paragraph 5, or paper 116, the preface, paragraph 5.
Thank you, Bob. Would you like to lead off in comments about these four quotes, or would you like to yield to someone else?
I'd yield. I'm going to think about these four. These are quite deep.
These quotations all pertain to the spiritual situation of human beings on our planet and the plans for our growth and development, although the final quotation that Bob DeBold read pertains to the future universe age and the various speculations that arise in regard to it. Who would like to comment?
I'll comment, Charles, speaking on the first one. The last sentence, quote, goals rather than creeds should unify religionists, end quote, by Melchizedek. That's the rub of it for us, I think. The authoritarian mind will not yield to this. It will insist upon a test of agreement. It defines, the authoritarian mind seems to define communication as agreement. If you don't agree, either because you either assume you don't understand, or you're being a heretic, or the equivalent of that, you're being obstreperous. The religion of the spirit, on the other hand, invites the different expressions based on varying perceptions. And it seems to me human destiny must embrace the latter. We have had a great deal of experience in this world on the authoritarian mind applied to religion, politics, society at large. And it generally causes wars of words or actual wars. Certainly, disagreements are perverted into conflicts, open conflict, and so forth and so on. But it amazes me. I've read many of the sacred texts of the various religions, the Tao Te Ching, the Gospels, the Bhagavad Gita, the Quran. And it amazes me how many adherents don't adhere to it. It seems that even the authoritarian mind, ironically, as much as it stresses uniformity, itself is not uniform. It's often arbitrary in its judgments. But I think the experiment with authority needs to be qualified and improved along the lines that we've been discussing. So going back to the original statement by the Melchizedek, goals such as the desire to be perfect, the desire to find God for yourself, should unify us. It's so important. It's of supreme importance.
Thank you, Charles.
I like that, yeah.
Further comments?
Well, it's just so paramount that we get to this place of mutual respect to where we can honor and tolerate the opinions, even if they are greatly different from our own. And I would maybe add a caveat, so long as they don't harm other human beings and debase them. But then again, you know, if that's the goal to honor the opinions of others and sincerely consider them. And, you know, the Urantia book reiterates throughout that we have to get to know one another, to love one another, specifically to know each other's motives and sentiments. And, you know, if you don't listen, sincerely listen to another person's point of view, you won't know that. And if you don't know that, you won't eventually fall in love with them, and there will be no brotherhood of mankind and, you know, peace on earth and goodwill among men and women. That won't happen. And that's an example of a goal that we might aspire to. And it's obviously very difficult for us. And one thing that comes to me is from the Mirantia Moda, where it says, you know, you can't force a spiritual nature. It can't be mechanically forced, you know, into the material memory mold. A pint can't hold a quart. So part of it, again, is what we were talking about last week, the patience to let men and women evolve and to maybe help that evolution and to have a sense about how long that's going to take. And not try to force it, or not be angry, become angry or impatient when it doesn't happen right away.
Paula, you're leading me right back into the primary focus of the study guide as a whole, which certainly is closely connected with the patience and, in the long run, the determination of the Master Seraphim to promote the growth of society and civilization, but to do so in ways that respect human will and human choice. They have no authority to force things upon us, and it would be not only dishonorable, but in conflict with their basic purpose if they were ever to abridge human will, which they cannot do.
Right.
Any additional remarks here?
Well, just that we try to do that a lot. We try to force our will on other humans a lot. As you pointed out with religion.
Unfortunately, traditional religion has been identified with authority having overtones of power over others.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems to me that this idea of power over others has to be abandoned as a characteristic of spirituality.
God alone is
Lord. Or as a characteristic of authority. You know, the idea is authority about the power over others, or is it about the ability to coordinate others lovingly? Is it the ability to lead others into the truth wherever it may lead, beauty and goodness, and the ability to love more? And this is unfortunately exactly where things are today, is that, it seems to me that that's always been the dichotomy, hasn't it? I mean, if you want to get reductionist about most universe problems, one way to reduce them is to say it's either about power or about love. And if you choose the lesser, the greater is excluded, which is the corollary to the wonderful Urantian phrase, which says if you choose the greater, the lesser is included. And the greater is always love, and that includes a certain kind of power, a real power. Jesus had real power over men and women. But it wasn't a power that was wielded through authority. It was a power that people willingly gave because of the love that they saw he had for them and the love that they therefore also had for him. And when you choose the power over the love is excluded. Somehow people get lost in the mix and they become subordinated to the need to grab for that power.
Thank you. I wonder if
Neil?
This might be a... I'm sorry, does someone else wish to add a thought?
Charles, I just want to make a few observations based on what's been said. I don't think authority is the issue. I think authoritarianism is the issue. You can be authoritative and respectful and dignified toward yourself and others. Authority is a form of power. Love is a form. I believe the contrast is not love and power, it's love and fear. That fear is the underlying destroyer. Love is the underlying unifier. And in my classroom, I only have three rules. One of them was, you may disagree, but never be you're forbidden to be disagreeable. That's how I got, that's how I articulate. Those are the actual words that I use. And that, by the way, was taken from a modification, a paraphrase of what something that Martin Luther King once said. You may disagree. If you must, but you are forbidden to be disagreeable, that is to say, disrespectful. Remember, respect is a virtue. Authority is something that's worthy of respect. It's very important to have authority, meaning you know something, you have knowledge, you're well-grounded, etc. Authoritarianism, on the other hand, is the enemy of respect, is the enemy of the search for truth. But being authoritative, as Jesus was authoritative, he was the very personification and exemplification of being authoritative. And the power he had over others was given to him by others, because he respected free will. The authoritarian mind seems either never to or very infrequently respects free will. It simply doesn't. It tries to override free will. So I would say we should foster love over fear, to vanquish fear, and use authority in a dignified, respectful way, and disagree as sincerely, but refrain from being disagreeable. Which that would, we can control all of that. Each one of us can control that.
Thank you, Charles. I think much of what you've said is a very good. I'm sorry, I have to move on. I'm concerned about getting through to the end of this section. We have two more quotations that I think flow both logically and conceptually from some of Charles's remarks about authority and respect. Paula, would you please read these two concluding quotations?
Oh, happily. These 24 men had a truly remarkable experience these 2 weeks when they were compelled to face problems and compose difficulties without Jesus. They learned to differ, to debate, to contend, to pray, and to compromise, and throughout it all to remain sympathetic with the other person's viewpoint and to maintain at least some degree of tolerance for his honest opinions. Written by the Midwayer Commission, page 1625, paragraph 8, paper 144, section 6, paragraph 11. The religions of authority can only divide men and set them in conscientious array against each other. The religion of the Spirit will progressively draw men together and cause them to become understandingly sympathetic with one another. The religions of authority require of men uniformity in belief, but this is impossible of realization in the present state of the world. The religion of the Spirit requires only unity of experience, uniformity of destiny, making full allowance for diversity of belief. The religion of the Spirit requires only uniformity of insight, not uniformity of viewpoint and outlook. The religion of the Spirit does not demand uniformity of intellectual views, only unity of spirit feeling. The religions of authority crystallize into lifeless creeds. The religion of the Spirit grows into the increasing joy and liberty of ennobling deeds of loving service and merciful ministration. Again, the Midwayer Commission, page 1732, paragraph 2, paper 155, section 6, paragraph 9.
Thank you, Paula. These two quotations leave a very warm and positive feeling. Does anyone wish to comment on them?
Well, they're certainly much closer to us in nature, and that might explain some of that. They also have had the remarkable experience, some of them having observed us since the days of Adam and Eve 37,000 years ago and more, and some from the times of the planetary prince, closer to 500,000 years ago. So that's with that kind of history, they certainly know what they're talking about in terms of what they're discussing. And so the first example, the idea of the 24 men, the apostles of John and the apostles of Jesus being left alone for 2 weeks is what this is referring to. That truly must have been a remarkable scene to witness, and I certainly look forward to watching this on the Universe replay sometime in the future. That's going to be wonderful to actually see how they did get to this. And when you look at the second one, this is clearly considered opinion over, respectively, 37,000 and 500,000 years of cumulative experience of watching us and watching how we do things. And mm-hmm. and the idea of saying, you know, that this is, again, it's a choice. It's this idea of, you know, to take Charles Rubric, the idea of, you know, fear and love. You know, if you are motivated by fear, you choose power over loving others or relationship with others. And if you choose love, then you don't have that fear, which motivates you to choose power over love. And I think that's being referred to here when they're talking about religions of authority and religion of the spirit. After all, the only true religion that is really being talked about in the Arantia book, aside from sometimes referring to the olden definition, the new definition of religion is purely personal religion, unadulterated relationship with God with no intermediaries. That's the real religion that they're referring to when they refer to the religion of the spirit. I hope I don't sound too authoritarian in making that pronouncement.
We thought your comments were very loving, Andre.
Well, my thought about all of that is in the last sentence, or right after the last semicolon Paula read, where they're talking about the liberty of loving service and merciful ministration becomes liberated, and it becomes ennobling deeds with the uniformity of insight, not the uniformity of viewpoint and outlook. So there's some real direct results that come out of all of this that we're talking about.
Thank
yeah,
you.
We
I
may
like...
want to...
Go ahead.
I just want to point out that's from Jesus's Discourse on Religion, that section. And so it's really what Jesus was saying to his apostles. So I just want to point that out. We said the Midware Commission, and they recorded it and reported it, but they give Jesus credit for having said it.
Thank you. I would like now to proceed to the first question in a formal sense that the study guide contains under this broad question that we've been reading. A, as the Master Seraphim work with human beings, endeavoring to influence them toward decisions and actions that will lead to the progressive growth of human society and civilization, how can they also seek to promote diversity, pluralism, and mutual respect?
Well,
I hope all of you will not answer it once.
We're all trying not to answer it once.
Well, let me just kick it off. You know, I don't have a lot to say on this. Well, I could, but let's just take for an example the angels of health and what they might be doing, and we might imagine that to be one of the larger of the cores, maybe not the largest, but one of the larger cores. Involving the various destiny reservists, and we know that, you know, they number somewhere between, you know, 41 and some larger number over 100. They would be fostering people that were dedicated to the mission and may have very, very different ideas as to what's important to work on in medicine, as an example. So. God is not a Johnny One Note, and neither are the Master Seraphim. They don't particularly. They're going to promote and help to foster anything that is good. And so, if somebody is working on the problem of heart disease, and somebody else is working on the problem of cancer, and someone else might be dealing with bionic limbs, and somebody else might be dealing with genetic problems, you can see where that's going. And somehow in the material realm, it's a lot easier to see why it might be valuable to be fostering a diversity of goals. It's harder to see that when you're starting to look at religion, at least from an authoritarian point of view. It's not so hard to see that if you also understand that they are trying to foster not just religion, but philosophy and a certain diversity in material life.
Thank you, Andre.
Go
right ahead.
No, go ahead, Bob. Absolutely, go ahead.
Well, I had a picture in my head as Andre was speaking about these other Master Seraphim groups, and thinking that, you know, it doesn't only pertain to religion, it does pertain to all 12 groups, in theory here. And I took the words diversity, pluralism, and mutual respect, and I drew a Venn diagram, so I'll try to explain what I've got here. Because out of that, as these three become intersected in some way, we've got seven domains. There's four intersections, of course. So if you have three circles that are intersecting, diversity and pluralism, I think, intersect into fellowship, for example. And pluralism and mutual respect intersect into brotherhood. And right in the center of this intersection, I wrote the words cosmic consciousness and spiritual harmony. We've talked a little bit about that. I know we talked about spiritual harmony, which is pretty much those two paragraphs that Paula just read. So these three terms are pretty interesting. And that's kind of the picture I have in my head. I hope I was able to describe that well enough for everybody to get a picture of it.
Interesting juxtapositions, yeah.
Yeah.
Paula, did you...
One thing that occurs to me, you know, they give us oftentimes these goals of getting to know each other, as I said before, of travel as being a good thing for the very purpose that you get to know each other. And when you expose yourself to diversity and pluralism, you develop mutual respect. I think if you're a kind-hearted person, you know, I mean, I guess some people aren't very tolerant of anybody, no matter how many times they go abroad or what. I guess you can't generalize about that, but I do think that travel and exposure to other cultures and other people and forms of diverse thinking is healthy for all of us. And it occurs to me that the internet is huge in this respect, in that it has actually leveled the playing field and allowed all of humanity to really communicate with each other in real time, almost, and to cross boundaries that never before were crossable. So I don't know if the Master Seraphim had anything to do with it, but I suspect that they knew it was coming, and they fostered it. And of course, it has its own inherent problems, and the passing of negative information is done freely, as well as good and positive information. But I just see it as a real good step towards being able to discover other cultures, discover the diversity of thought, discover pluralism, and embrace it and learn from it.
Thank you, Paula. I would add a comment of my own based on the circulation of information that you have described. In the past, authoritarian regimes or totalitarian regimes have sought to control the ideas that the people living in those countries can have access to. This is becoming increasingly difficult, or perhaps even impossible. I give as an example the regime of mainland China, a government run by the Communist Party of China, which has established a huge censorship regime for the internet, but it doesn't work. People find out ways in which they can hop past the censorship regime by having access to websites located elsewhere. And it's a game that keeps going on. But basically, the censorship regime in Communist China is not working with 100% effectiveness. It may be down there at 65 or 70%, and they're going to continue doing it. But the people of China, as in other countries where the regime seeks to control their opinions, are not going to accept that. And this is a new situation in the world because of the technological advances that Paula mentioned. Does anyone else wish to comment on diversity or pluralism or mutual respect?
Yes, Charles speaking.
Thank you.
I think, in my view, if you successfully foster mutual respect, everything else will follow in terms of the freedom to be diverse, pluralism, and many other good behaviors. Respect is first and foremost a virtue. It's an ethical, ethically speaking, a virtue. And it is so powerful that even, and it should not be confused, by the way, with agreement or popularity. Respect is, I think, far higher than either of those. Respect can easily embrace or deal with disagreement. And if you respect someone, it's very, most people, I think all rational people, not necessarily educated, but rational persons, will not be disagreeable to someone they respect. Who would, for example, use profanity in front of their grandmother? They respect the status. Respect is a pearl of great price. It's a very powerful virtue. And it is so powerful that even enemies, even one's enemies, can respect you. Indeed, respect, I don't think, can be begged, borrowed, or stolen. Everyone seems to know the real thing from the fake thing. It can only be earned. And again, enemies, even one's enemies, can respect one. Not just people who disagree with you, but one's enemies. And that's often the case. That's how profound respect, the virtue of respect is. I think mutual respect is the pearl of great price that should be sought after. If you were to separate out and put in a list of priorities, I would put mutual respect, or respect and mutual respect, very, very high on any list.
Thank you, Charles.
So how do you get there?
I'm going to have to cut off here because we have a ways to go and only a half an hour left in the program. I now proceed to sub-question B. Given the millennium of changes, adjustments, and readjustments that Melchizedek predicts in paper 99 on page 1086, paragraphs 4 through 6 of the one-column edition, in paper 99, section 1, paragraphs 1 through 3, and these are three paragraphs that were previously cited in the context of question 7, it is reasonable to believe that actions and measures will come and go, and that a particular step that is appropriate and useful in one region of the world may be premature or disadvantageous in another region. And since the progressive growth of human society and civilization is more likely to be complex and uneven than simple, straightforward, and direct, no one can predict the specific steps that will be appropriate and necessary in each field of human life, while society repeatedly regenerates itself over the next 1,000 years. On the other hand, the process of creativity and innovation must and will persist, and that will be the case in every region of the world throughout the entire millennium. Now, I will pause here because I want to give participants a chance to comment on the points that this paragraph makes. Namely, unpredictability in outcome, but a definite predictability in the process of search and experiment. Who would like to comment on this?
Well, I'd love to just interject with a vision that came to mind as you were talking about this. You know, when you think about the first revelation to mankind, that of the planetary prince coming. You know, the whole problem with the rebellion was trying to do too much too fast and doing it deliberately and knowingly when wisdom said, this will not work. Trying to go one's own way and ignoring social and spiritual and many other kinds of laws that the celestial beings certainly are well, well aware of. But particularly the social ones, the ideas that society evolves by stages. And what this presented to me was this idea of imagine the master seraphim having in front of them, with regard to all of these problems, maps or, you know, various sector maps, or I mean, which would indicate by family, by region, by nation, by tribe, by county, not with regard to every problem, but by so many other different gradations. You can use these principles here, but not these. You can use those principles there, but not these other ones. And I'm just envisioning that while this would not be, you know, a literal necessarily map by which they had to follow or something like that, they would have this internalized literally, that they would understand literally at what stage each person, each family, each group was at, and that they could only go so far in terms of a method that they could employ, that if they went further, they might be courting a certain kind of tragedy or disaster.
Of course, implicit in what you've just said is the realization that the Master Seraphim have to seek to inspire or assist human beings who are living in these different environments. They cannot do it themselves.
Well, right. And the idea being, though, that they can't you know, incite people to go beyond, too far beyond where they already are. You know, over-revelations are disastrous, and so we're not given one. We're given a revelation which largely corroborates what we already know and only fills in the gaps of what we could not possibly discover for ourselves. That's largely the nature of the fifth epical revelation. But that in and of itself, that kind of coordination of knowledge and wisdom that has so much of which has already been discovered previously on the planet, but has never been correlated and has never been elevated or illuminated in the way that it has in the Urantia revelation, is a revelation. And it would seem that that's how the Master Seraphim would work as well, slowly revealing, taking us from whatever stage we are and moving us forward from there, whether it be in, you know, whatever country, you know, you name it, whatever part of the world or whatever stage of civilization.
One more contributor here, and then I'm sorry, I'm going to have to cut it off. Who would like to be the final contributor on this thought? Is that Bob DeBolt?
Yes. Now, let me draw a string between what Paul and Andre both said. I completely agree with both in that we're dealing with a planet that's functioning at different speeds of knowledge. But yet, as Paul said, we're still dealing with this capability, you know, even though some of it's tried to be restricted in certain countries and certain locations. There was a great article by Alvin Toffler in the New York Times about 6 or 7 years ago, and he had a picture of the planet, you know, the globe, and on some parts he had transistors, and other parts he had chips, and other parts he had donkeys walking around. And so, you know, to the point that moving different locations too fast, too far, will be a problem, and needs to be some of the wisdom that is applied here. Hopefully we can make good decisions as we go forward, as I'm sure that the Master Seraphim must be looking at some of these things and saying, how did some of them get so far behind, or how did some of them get so far ahead?
Thank you.
Good points.
I would like you to show me your cooperation here, please, because I have to go forward in order to complete the rather complex questions that occur on the final page. In introducing these questions, we are, by implication, comparing the progression of social and cultural evolution that the Master Seraphim are fostering with the progression of biological evolution that the life carriers fostered. There are, on the top of the next page, quotations that apply to the life carriers describing the constraints that they were forced to operate under. And then we go on through the page about how there may be comparable limitations or comparable expectations that restrict what the Master Seraphim can do. So the final page in this study guide, the final page in this particular question, is implicitly a comparison of the work of the life carriers and the work of the Master Seraphim. Now, without further ado, I will proceed to read this entire page of material, which concludes with a very difficult question that I hope some of you will seek to answer at the very end. So now, here we go. At the bottom of page 13, it starts, "Since the Master Seraphim received extensive training during their arduous ascent to Seraphington, it seems entirely appropriate to believe that they are far more familiar with the process of social and cultural evolution than we are. Even though this process is undoubtedly quite different from biological evolution, intriguing observations by a life carrier may stimulate useful comparisons and analogies. Quote, it will hardly be possible to explain to the present-day human mind many of the queer and apparently grotesque occurrences of early evolutionary progress. A purposeful plan was functioning throughout all of these seemingly strange evolutions of living things, but we are not allowed arbitrarily to interfere with the development of the life patterns after they have once been set in operation. Life carriers may employ every possible natural resource and may utilize any and all fortuitous circumstances which will enhance the developmental progress of the life experiment, but we are not permitted mechanically to intervene in or arbitrarily to manipulate the conduct and course of either plant or animal evolution." This quotation by a life carrier on page 733, paragraph 7 and 8 of the one column edition, or in paper 65, section 3, paragraphs 1 and 2. The next quotation, "It was our intention to produce an early manifestation of will in the evolutionary life of Urantia, and we succeeded. Ordinarily, will does not emerge until the colored races have long been in existence, usually first appearing among the superior types of the red man. Your world is the only planet in Satania where the human type of will has appeared in a pre-colored race. But in our effort to provide for that combination and association of inheritance factors which finally gave rise to the mammalian ancestors of the human race, we were confronted with the necessity of permitting hundreds and thousands of other and comparatively useless combinations and associations of inheritance factors to take place. Many of these seemingly strange byproducts of our efforts are certain to meet your gaze as you dig back into the planetary past, and I can well understand how puzzling some of these things must be to the limited human viewpoint." Again, a quotation by a life carrier, page 736, paragraphs 2 and 3 in the one column edition, paper 65, section 4, paragraphs 11 and 12. Resuming the question, "It is clear that the limitations that constrained the life carriers cannot apply to the Master Seraphim in exactly the same ways. To be sure, the life carriers were not permitted mechanically to intervene in or arbitrarily to manipulate the conduct and course of either plant or animal evolution, but it is important to remember that the life carriers were operating in the physical realm, matter, whereas the Master Seraphim are operating in mind. In practice, the Master Seraphim function as ideational clearinghouses, mind focalizers, and project promoters, and they often act to intensify some higher ideal which has already appeared within a human intellect." Quotation from the Chief of Seraphim, page 1256, paragraph 9 in the one column edition, paper 114, section 6, paragraph 19. Resuming the question, "Do you therefore believe that these capabilities of theirs are so potent and so effective as to eliminate the possibility that humanity will encounter hundreds and thousands of comparatively useless combinations and associations while society evolves during the next 1,000 years? On the other hand, do you suspect that the sovereignty and unpredictability of the human will and the consequent vagaries of human choices and decisions will engender an ample collection of comparatively useless combinations and associations, and that these outcomes are so likely as to be essentially unavoidable. If so, are there strategies that the Master Seraphim should adopt in order to diminish this wasted motion and unproductive churning? Well, there we are, ladies and gentlemen. Your final examination is now coming. Who would like to take
I'll be happy to start it off, if I may. Charles speaking.
Go ahead.
I think first of all, in the last paragraph, the latter question prevails as the problem. There will always be many wasted motions because human beings necessarily, given human nature and human circumstances, experience trial and error at a minimum. And I think the deeper problem, the greater, broader and deeper problem confronting the Master Seraphim now is that our animal legacy generates fear. And fear, in combination with free will, make the best plans go awry. Is make the best plan go awry, and they will have to deal with that human combination. And in general, they will have to undercut human fear, at the same time force the human hope through love, God's love, directly and indirectly. So fear is the culprit. Fear is what they have to, human fear. And unfortunately for us, it goes back to our animal nature. And there are a number of statements in the book about the influence of the animal nature in human nature. And I thought about how this might be done, some of the ways this might be done, and I came up with, it was very challenging, by the way, Neil. I found this the most difficult question to address. And you more or less characterize it that way. First of all, there are spiritual values that the Master Seraphim can promote, moral and spiritual values. Beginning all premise on God's love. Nothing's going to work apart from God's love. The fatherhood of God is the basis of the brotherhood of man. Faith. They particularly have to give attention to trust. Trust, willingness in human beings. And forgiveness. They must give strong attention to that. They have to help to foster a sense of a secured human destiny. In other words, that we have a future. Despite all the vicissitudes of the world, particularly since the First World War, starting approximately 100 years ago, they have to, when optimism was gravely, grimly undermined, they have to reverse that to foster a sense through selected leaders, human leaders, of destiny. I think they have to promote a greater scope and depth of education in the art of living. Mm-hmm. And this includes a higher, clearer sense of human purpose and meaning, promoting logic and reason, a more seasoned rationality. In other words, helping humans develop a better sense of proportion and sequence of things in time and space. So much of the animal legacy of fear produces irrational behavior. We distress ourselves with imaginings, as one poet put it. But I think most important, I agree with the Buddhists in this, because they focus on this very, very strongly. They have to foster a tendency in human nature in the future, now and in the future, to curb human appetites. In other words, to balance human mortal needs and wants. I think these are some of the ways that they might undo to a certain extent, perhaps minimize to a certain extent, wasted motion, unproductive churning, comparatively useless combinations and associations, and so forth. If you can at least diminish fear and augments the hope that is in love, you can go a long way, very, very long way.
Mm-hmm.
I'll finish with that.
Charles, I think you've given us a menu of discussion, perhaps an appetite for discussion, that we could probably dwell on for the next hour, but we only have 15 minutes, so I yield to the next person who would like to comment.
Well,
Paul, you want to take a stab? Or Bob?
Go ahead. Sure, I'll be short here, because you know, I know there's other things to say here. It occurred to me a number of things are coming to fruition here from the study. You know, one is time. You know, being able to not do things too fast, as Adam and Eve did. Looking at the life carriers, they're dealing with hundreds of millions of years. When humans become humans, and on Infanta, we're talking just over a million years. And if we look at the way that society is moving today, the you know, now we've got not just the agitate minds that the life carriers dealt with, but we've got the Holy Spirit, the Spirit of Truth. We've got adjusters. We've got this whole pantheon of celestials here, which includes observers, I suppose. And if, you know, if we're looking at it correct, Ray Kurzweil says that we're at the bend in the curve, technology-wise anyway, and we may have to find ways to help slow some things down, to be honest with you, to think about this a little bit deeper. So I think that in answer to Neil's original question, let me go back and see exactly what the original one was. Are there strategies, is the end of the question, that we would diminish the wasted motion and unproductive churning? I don't think there'll be as much wasted motion and unproductive churning because we're dealing with mind now and multiple spirit over controls that are working in mind and with what the Master Seraphim have to do, such as Project Promote and Mind Focalize, they're honing this down, I think. So a couple of random thoughts there, so I'll kind of throw that on the table and back off here now.
Thank you, Bob. I heard brief chuckles from both Paula and Andre. Would one of you like to take the floor next?
Well, can I just say all of the above?
All right.
In answer to this question, I think that you could answer yes to the first two questions. And to the third question, I think you could answer yes to both, I think. I think both are probably going to happen. And I think to the third question, I don't see the churning as unproductive. I see it as necessary. It's like the churning of rocks in a tumbler. If you want to polish rocks, you got to churn them, and you know, or the cutting of a diamond. You know, I mean, this is just, and I think they know this. They see. You know, it's like his last statement in the last quote that you gave us, Neil. I can well understand how puzzling some of these things must be to the limited human viewpoint. God bless him for that, the life carrier. He can well see that. He doesn't have a limited viewpoint. He has seen thousands upon thousands of human beings, millions perhaps, evolve over great, you know, spanses of time. He sees this work every time. It works well. It works in the long run. And we're circumscribed to 100 years. My husband Glenn calls it the 100-year plan. We get 100 years to make a little to put one piece of the puzzle in place of the bazillion piece puzzle. And so we have our job to do, and if we'll just cooperate with them the tiniest little bit, it'll make their job a little easier. They've got it in hand. At least that's my understanding of it. If we're willing to cooperate and to the best of our ability, spread a little love and good cheer around down here, we're going to make the world a better place, and they can build on that, and the next generation will come along, and you know, and hence the great emphasis on family life and the responsibility of parents to raise children who are ethical and moral, to give them a good, sound beginning in life so that they can carry the torch forward in the next generation and so on and so forth.
I'm delighted at your very optimistic tone. I think it epitomizes the point that Charles made earlier about love rather than fear.
Mm-hmm.
Would Andre like to add now some thoughts?
Yes, and I'll try and be concise in our last 10 minutes here on the Cosmic Citizen. First of all, what a wonderful study. Where this leads me is, number one, to look at the fact that it seems to me that everything in evolution does not try to minimize this kind of endless churning right away. It does allow for a lot of uselessness to come about in many, many different realms. But in the first place, a really good quote to corroborate, whether or not they, on other worlds, they think that this is going to, that they're worried about this in a social sense, when they talk about the continental nation and government on a neighboring planet, and they talk about the development from the tribal stage, the appearance of strong rulers and kings occupied thousands of years. The unconditional monarchs were succeeded by many different orders of government, abortive republics, communal states, and dictators came and went in endless profusion, and on and on. Do they on any world try to limit what shows up? It seems only as wise parents would limit us, throwing ourselves off of cliffs and walking in front of a train, or that kind of thing. Wise parents allow kids to make mistakes, but they don't allow them to die, hopefully. And that seems to be maybe where some of the limits are. But there's also another curious aspect to the analogy here that when you bring up the life carriers, and that is all of these things were necessary in the first two paragraph quote, and even in the second paragraph quote, in order to bring about human will. And then what do the life carriers do when human will comes about? They withdraw. Why? All of a sudden something has appeared on the planet that now has the right to govern itself.
Oh.
And that was the pinnacle of evolution. Mm. The idea was, now we have something within life itself that is designed to help to govern itself. So with regard to all these useless, churnings and everything, and I'm reminded as well of mechanical developments. When you look back 150 years to all the attempts before the Wright brothers, to bring about flying machines of all kinds of contraptions that didn't work. Did they allow them to happen?
Mm.
Sure.
Mm-hmm.
They allowed every one. Some of them hurt people badly, I'm sure. But here, what's the idea? Once you get to something that works, when it works well, it carries things along so well that it was worth everything that it took to get there. And I think the analogy here for society is it's worth it to get to the teacher son age, or to light in life, or to the magisterial son age, whatever stage that is, where it will seem that we're much more unified and on board with what is going on. And so they will still try to foster a lot of different things and allow a lot of comparatively useless things to come into existence, like Al-Qaeda and the Taliban, which from Al-Qaeda's point of view and the Taliban's point of view are not comparatively useless churnings, but from a wider perspective might be.
I think you have identified, in effect, the patience that the Master Seraphim must apply, and by implication, the comparison with the patience that the life carriers applied. One of you mentioned before the question of the timeline required and the fact of a process going on for an extended period, which they, the Master Seraphim, are not able to shorten. They're required to observe the freedom of the human will to make choices. They can stimulate us, but they cannot compel it. And in the end, the people of Urantia own the results. We have the satisfaction of achieving these advances. We are not puppets. It is to our credit, not just the credit of the angels who are helping us. We have done this ourselves. At least that will be the result eventually. In the long run, we have a few hurdles to jump on the way.
Yeah.
I just want to say that I have petitioned the universe government officially, just so you know, you'll be my witnesses, that when we make it to Light and Life on this most difficult planet, that everybody who participated in that grand adventure get to come back and have one big party and just really, really
but
light
you may
that
be
candle.
Conflicting with Charles' Paul. Idea of suppressing appetites, Paula.
Yeah.
What a great day.
Good idea, though.
Yeah. Well, I put it out there. I don't know what they're going to do with it, but we'll see.
Well, Andre spoke earlier of watching the replay of the 24 apostles of Jesus and of John. And so I assume that even if we are not allowed to come back, Paula, we'll be allowed to visit the instant replay.
Okay. Well, Neil, thank you so very much for this wonderful study. It's just been a delight, and I know now you want to go on a little bit and say something about the global endeavor. So,
thank you very much. I would like to express my appreciation to all of you in this discussion, which I have found fascinating. If the people who have downloaded the study guide are still looking at the text in front of them, I would ask them to direct their attention to page 17. Actually, the study guide itself emerged from a prior decision by the Committee for the Global Endeavor to use the work of the Master Seraphim as the spiritual model for a project involving readers of the Urantia book who aspire to act toward other human beings with the same loving support that the Master Seraphim show. So let me read what it says on page 17. The Global Endeavor is an entirely independent project that will provide a new option that may be attractive to readers of the Urantia book who would like to serve others in the spirit of the Master Seraphim. The path of idealistic service described in the plan will operate in parallel to study groups and in parallel to social organizations. This new path is neither a substitute nor a competitor, and it will require a very different kind of active engagement. I condensed the rest out of interest in time. We are seeking to stimulate participation in a wide range of countries so as to avoid domination just by citizens of the United States. The material we have developed has been translated into French. About two-thirds of the Spanish translation has been prepared. We hope to involve people from many countries, including speakers of Spanish and French, as well as speakers of English. Please, for those of you who are somewhat interested in this, take a close look at the website, www.globalendeavor.net, the same place from which you may have downloaded the study guide. Thank you very much to Paula for this opportunity. I thank our contributors, Andre Redatus, Charles Olivier, Crystalline B. Larson, who's not with us today, and Bob DeBold, my close colleague and friend on the Committee for the Global Endeavor. And I express great pleasure in being able to be with you during this discussion of a very detailed study guide that I had the honor to prepare.
And Neil, thank you for all of your work. And Bob, thank you for your work with Neil on this project. And a lot of the people on the board have said that they hope that you guys will come back and do another study with us again. And maybe you'll give us an update on how the Global Endeavor is doing and, you know, the progress. And I hope all of our listeners will go to your website. I posted it on the board. And check it out. So thank you so much for your efforts and your contribution.
Thank you very much. It's been a tremendous pleasure and a great honor.
Thank you. And thanks to the Arantia Book Fellowship for making the Cosmic Citizen possible by funding it and helping it grow. So my hat's off to you, Fellowship. And thanks to our listeners.
And this just wouldn't have been the same without Charles and everyone. Thank you.
Thank you. Yes. And until next time, my friends, bye for now.
Bye.
Bye now. Thanks, Paula.
You bet.
Bye-bye and thanks, and look forward to the next time that we can all be together. I think we're off the air.
We are.
Yes, and just maybe to cap off, thank you so much, everybody. This was Neil, first of all, for suggesting this and putting this together and having this available. I know this has been available for some time now, but the idea that this has actually gotten to, you know, be fleshed out in a certain sense, live and with people that haven't been familiar with it, you know, in a formal. So I don't know how many times you've done this formally, but this is wonderful to have been able to do this with you. But Charles, thank you so much, and Bob, for having you know, come on and done this. This wouldn't have been the same study without all your ideas. And,
well, thanks for having me on.
Yeah, it really became wonderful. It added new colors.
Yes, absolutely.
thank you for that, Andre. And it's been, as I said before, wonderful. It's been a delight, a great joy to do this study. Just a great joy. And I too, feel it's an honor in addition to a great joy. And I'm moved by it, and I'm very grateful, and I feel blessed to have had the experience. And I hope it was a benefit.
I would implicitly respond. I would respond to the implicit question that Andre posed. This extremely interesting discussion by a series of broadcasts was the first time that, to my knowledge, anyone has participated in a comprehensive discussion of the study guide. We have had meetings in which particular questions were discussed by individual groups, or for that matter, by individual readers who gave their opinions. But this is the first time that the entire study guide has been analyzed and discussed in detail. And I believe that the combination of people who shared their insights in this discussion was a very fruitful combination. The benefit of having a diversity of background and personal experience showed itself during every broadcast. In other words, the fact that all of you have different histories and different experiences and different specialties contributed a tremendous amount to the breadth of the discussion, and I'm grateful for all of that.
Hey, if you guys have a few minutes, our friend from England who has listened to these broadcasts is holding, and I'd like to put him on. I don't think he expects it, but it would sure be nice to get his feedback. Sean, are you with us?
Hi, Paula. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Hi.
Hi, Sean.
Yeah, hi there, guys. I only caught the last 15 or 20 minutes of this discussion, unfortunately, because of the time zone difference. So what I will do is, when I get some time, I will download the pod. I'll download the MP3 and listen to it. But I only really caught about the last 15 or 20 minutes. So, and I'm also still very much at the early stage of my, your answer book studies. So I'm very much a, a beginner, whereas I think you guys have obviously been studying for many, many years. So, but nevertheless interesting. And I would like to, you know, perhaps contribute at a later discussion. But I'm just very conscious that, you know, I'm surrounded by experts, and I don't know enough yet. I don't want to make too much of a fool of myself on the air.
Fellow students,
we're no longer on the air, so we welcome any comments.
Feel free, Sean.
That limits the damage.
Yeah.
It's just the archive now.
Maybe just one very general point I'd make is that I was interested in one of the speakers mentioned that you wanted to try and bring in more of an international audience, and obviously I appreciate that at least the transcribing of the Urantia book originally happened in the US. I think it was Chicago, I believe, and obviously a lot of the experts that I hear on this podcast and other podcasts are from the US, but I think it would be a good thing if Paula, I mentioned this in an email to you, that there doesn't seem to be enough Urantia book students outside the US, and that is something that I would, you know, very much applaud and encourage if the community could be expanded internationally.
Sean, you may not be aware that there actually is a branch of students who are interested in the Urantia book in the UK and Ireland. This is a branch of the Urantia Association International, the UAI. In fact, this group is sponsoring a gathering in North Wales that will occur next week.
Right. Well, I live about 3 miles from North Wales, so that would be
great.
Oh,
perfect.
Yay!
And Paul, I think you have my email. Would you be good enough to email me the details of that? I'm just on my iPad at the moment, and I've got nothing to write on.
Absolutely, and in fact, if you will send it to me, Neil, I will send it on to Sean.
Okay.
Or I can send you Sean's email.
The key person that would be happy to help Sean is Gary Rawlings, Rawlings.
Okay.
And I can provide the contact information to you, Paula, whenever it's convenient.
Okay. Yeah, just send it to me in an email.
Next week.
Yes, it's the weekend, and you may not be able to arrange so suddenly, but Gary can give you information about the general activities of the association for the UK and Ireland, of which this conference is essentially an annual event, in this case being held in North Wales.
Excellent. That's great news. I'll look forward to getting an email from you, Paula, when you've got a second.
Of course, happily.
Okay.
And there are study groups that meet in the UK. I would encourage you to find a study group that may be convenient for you to join in discussing portions of the Urantia book with people who live in your area, if that works out for you.
Yeah, I mean, definitely. I just wasn't aware that there were any, but I mean, I think that this group in North Wales. I mean, if you've got any other information, any other groups, please, you know, by all means, email it to me. Paula has my email address. Maybe send it to Paula and she can forward it on. I would definitely like to get in contact with any other groups in the UK.
Good. The event is in North Wales. It's not really a group in North Wales, but the National Association for the UK and Ireland happens to be having its conference for the year in North Wales. And so I think the best information would come from Gary Rawlings when you've been able to get in touch with him.
Great. Okay, well, thanks very much for letting me contribute to the discussion, albeit at the end of the official podcast.
You're most welcome, Sean. Thanks for joining us.
Good to have you.
Okay. Delighted
you.
To hear from you.
Bye-bye, Sean.
Bye now. Take care.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
Well, ladies and gentlemen,
again,
I think this is goodbye to all of you, isn't it?
Yes,
but let's do it again.
Well, Neil,
such sweet sorrow.
Not goodbye. Yeah. Why don't you say to be continued?
To be continued.
In French, au revoir.
I'll just say I look forward to how this might develop in your own mind in terms of whether you make any changes to this study guide or whether it inspires something else, another study guide that is a follow-on to this, because this was, you put together a rather remarkable study, and I realize your efforts may take you in different directions now, but this was wonderful. So again, thank you for the privilege of letting us do this and be literally the first to do this after this has been in existence for so many years.
And it was well received, too.
March of 2011. But you did have positive comments, Paula?
Yes, very much so, Neil. It's been very well received. And
great.
In my opinion, yes, very much so.
Excellent. Well, Andre, I have to tell you
Neil, let me just put in a plug both for Paula, Andre, and Charles. They've been at this for a number of years, and we really appreciate you all pushing this forward. I've gone back and listened to some of the old ones 3-4 years ago, and you are truly servicing the universe. Nice
job. Well, thank you, Bob. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm so glad that we could plug in, you know, and do this. I'm just very grateful for it.
Also, Paula and Andre and Crystalline, it's a wonderful host. You are easy to work with, and you are consistent. You show no bias or favoritism. There's no rudeness. There's courtesy and politeness. And in my long professional career, that's not always been the case. So I give you a grade of A+.
Oh.
Well, thank you.
That's like a blessing from the Pope.
Well, I didn't think it came from that high. But I do know whereof I speak in terms of educational circles, shall we say, or learning circles, teaching circles. I do know whereof I speak, and I do give you an A+. And my only regret is that every private and public school teacher in America, especially public school teacher, and every public school administrator, especially, and boards of education, could not be a witness to how you run the blog, how you operate the Cosmic Radio Show. They could learn a great deal about how to run schools in terms of the terms that I listed. I cited.
Thank you, Charles.
I associate myself with the very complimentary remarks that Charles has just made. I would say that in the spirit of our discussion today, these principles of diversity, pluralism, and mutual respect are a characteristic of the program that three of you, Crystalline, Andre, and Paula, have been operating, and it's wonderful.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, we do. We have really strived for that, and you know, I think we all understand that controversy sometimes draws a lot more attention, but that's never been what we want to do. So we really want to illuminate. We want to put off light, not heat. So thank you so much, you guys.
And I wanted to say, Neil, I love the scholarship of the paper.
Great.
I have a high regard for scholarship. I love the scholarship of the paper. I more than like it and more than respect it. I love it. I love the attitude. I love the competence, the proficiency, the precision. I love the fact that you put pros and cons. It's not presumptuous. As much as one can render a complex subject, you made it plain. My brother, you made it plain.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm delighted to have reached that level of performance in your estimation. It certainly embodies goals that I had in mind when I was working on it. And I have to mention, of course, that my colleagues in the committee made many helpful suggestions as I was working on the study guide, and they deserve a fair amount of the credit as well.
Well, and you moderated that discussion beautifully too, Neil, so thank you.
Thank you, Paula. I was a bit nervous today. You probably could tell because I was concerned that we would run out of time. And so at some points, I arbitrarily cut off discussion, but I think you understood that I felt I had to.
Oh, it was good.
Absolutely. You did great. Yeah.
Thank you.
We did, Neil. It worked well. It was relatively smooth. I wouldn't give it any further concern if you are.
No, but I appreciate your cooperation, and if I chopped off somebody in the middle of some interesting thought, I regret that. But we had to get through it, and I'm delighted that we did.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah.
Well done.
Thank you.
So parting is such sweet sorrow.
Yeah.
Was that a quotation from a barber there?
What?
Paula, was your quotation about parting something you heard at a barbershop?
Yeah.
I'm shaking here.
Exactly.
I once gave a sermon, Paula, by that text, that death is a parting that's a sweet sorrow. I won't repeat the sermon here, but it made a wonderful text at a memorial service for my wife's godfather. Because the minister forgot the time of the service, so I offered to do it, and I was accepted by his widow. Parting is such a sweet sorrow. It's a beautiful phrase from Shakespeare.
It is.
And,
yeah.
And it applies to death in a beautiful way.
I like to say that the heart is a timeless, spaceless place. It's like paradise in that no matter how much time and space comes between people who love one another, when they're together again, it's just like no time or space ever came between them.
That brings
yeah.
to mind the quotation from one of the authors of the Urantia book that personality relationships are not scaffolding and that
mm-hmm.
they are served into the mansion worlds.
Right.
Right. Relationships are ends, not means.
Right.
Right.
Our treasures in heaven.
They are.
So look forward to furthering this one that I have with each of you. This is wonderful. Neil, I think the last time we saw each other was in a line in the planetarium in Boulder. might be the last time that I saw you, and maybe the first time.
I must confess that your memory is better than mine. I do recall being there, but
yeah.
I can't recall too much about meeting you. I'm sorry.
Yeah, that's fine. That's fine. We had. We met and we had a little bit of a short conversation in the line, I think, as we were waiting to get to the dinner plates.
I assume it was not quite as inspiring as these conversations have been.
No, actually, it was a wonderful introduction. It was nice meeting you. Yeah. So anyway, this is wonderful. It's wonderful to see how things continue and that we'll all get opportunities to be with each other again. God only knows when.
Are you all going to Chicago?
Unfortunately,
well,
I will not
am.
Be. But I look forward to trying to get to a summer study session. I look forward to getting to IC14 probably next year and maybe some other gatherings this year. But... anyway, enjoy yourselves, those of you that will make it there.
Paul, I'm sure I'll see you there. And Charles, are you heading up there? Over there?
Regretfully, not this occasion.
Well, we're sure going to
miss you, Paul.
Yeah, it'll be good to see you guys.
I will miss you.
Yeah.
Yeah, likewise.
Well, it's something that I've mentioned before, I'm going to this gathering in North Wales in the UK, which is occurring next weekend.
Good.
So I will not be in Chicago, but I have to go to the UK. And this is in the direction of increasing international interest in the global endeavor.
Wonderful.
Which is wonderful, yeah.
Lucky. Lucky you,
Thank
Neil.
You.
Well, I guess
the best thing to do now is to say goodbye to all of my wonderful friends who've been such an inspiration during our discussions.
Thank you.
Well, likewise, yeah.
Likewise.
Bye for now.
To all of you.
Bye.
Until
yes.
next we meet.
Again,
love
bye,
to
everybody.
You all.
Bye-bye.
Bye for now.
Again, my love to all of you. Adios.
Adios.
Much love.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to The Cosmic Citizen, a radio program focused primarily on the study and discussion of the Urantia Book and its teachings. The Urantia Book is a religious text that claims to be written by angels and other superhuman personalities. If you are a Urantia Book reader or a spiritual seeker looking for new truth, we hope and pray you have been nourished and edified by our ministry. Please remember that the views expressed on this program do not reflect the official views and opinions of any Urantia organizations. There is no official interpretation of the Urantia Book. So all opinions expressed on this program exclusively reflect the personal biases of the hosts, guests, and callers who participate in these discussions. And remember, only a brave person is willing honestly to admit and fearlessly to face what a sincere and logical mind